You're listening to The Stressless Life with Dr. Yip, a podcast about conquering your fears and overcoming anxiety. Our question for the day is, what is the state-of-the-art treatment for social anxiety? I am your host, Dr. Noah Larracy. Let's say hello to Dr. Yip.
Hello, Noah.
Dr. Yip is a licensed psychologist who's board certified in behavioral and cognitive therapy and an expert in the treatment of anxiety and OCD. And today we're recording from Washington, D.C., where we're attending the ADAA, or Anxiety and Depression Association of America Conference, and we have a very special guest, Stefan Hoffman. Hello, Stefan.
Hello.
Stefan Hoffman, Ph.D., is a professor of psychology at Boston University, where he directs the Psychotherapy and Emotion Research Laboratory. He's also editor-in-chief of Cognitive Therapy and Research and the associate editor of Clinical Psychological Science. So we wanted to talk to Stefan today because he is one of the leading researchers on social anxiety, if not the leading researcher. So first, could you tell our audience, what does an anxiety researcher do?
Well, an anxiety researcher, I guess, researches anxiety. I've been involved in developing and understanding anxiety disorder and disorder treatments. So we're trying to, you know, improve the lives of people. That's basically our mission.
And how did you get interested in social anxiety specifically?
It's not uncommon to experience moments of social anxiety. So it's quite of a, it was an interest of mine when I started doing my dissertation back in the early 90s at Stanford. And we did something on public speaking anxiety. And I was primarily working in the field of psychophysiology. And so we were interested in effects of speaking in public on psychophysiological measures and the like. And then I thought, many of these people probably could also use some help. And so we started treatments with these individuals. And that really sort of took off then. And we sort of tried to figure out how to improve the treatments further. And so here I am, I guess.
And how do you differentiate social anxiety from shyness?
Well, shyness is a personality trait that has been researched primarily by personality and social psychologists. It is a temperament. It's a temperamental trait that simply characterizes people similar to introversion versus extroversion. Some people are more or less shy. Now, if fear of interacting with others reaches a level of distress or interference that impairs people's lives, then often we're looking at social anxiety disorder. But shyness is less clearly defined. It is a much more of a trait that some people have or don't have, and some people would even claim that the majority of individuals have some degrees of shyness. Some people distinguish public versus private shyness. But social anxiety disorder is a really different animal. These are people who suffer greatly from their distress, from their disorder, and live very isolated and lonely lives.
Can you, I guess, help the audience understand what exactly is social anxiety disorder then?
I think it's a group of disorders. So that also makes it challenging to treat. And however, if you figure it out, you can treat it very successfully. But the important thing is to identify the factors for each individual that drives the problem. I think there are some commonalities and there are some important differences between individuals with social anxiety disorder. The commonality is the fear of negative evaluation by others. That sort of is the overriding feature that all people with this problem share. And this is a very common problem. So social anxiety disorder is the most common, or, you know, with specific phobia. Some epidemiological studies suggest it's social anxiety disorder, others specific phobia. So we get it in 13% is a lifetime prevalence rate of the disorder. And it is sort of ranks it number one or two of anxiety disorders and one of the three most common mental disorders in the population. Some people start having this problem very early on. Others develop it late in life. There's a huge heterogeneity in that. Some people experience panic features, others not so much. Some people have even anger issues associated with it, others not so much. There's some degree of behavioral inhibition in some people with a high degree of shyness. For others, it's not the issue. For some people, it's very isolated, focused on a few situations that require, say, public speaking or other performance situations. For others, it is much more generalized and they fear most or all situations. So again, it is a heterogeneous group, but all of these individuals have in common that they fear being negatively evaluated.
So being negatively evaluated, could that also be true for someone experiencing shyness? For the audience, because we have a lot of people who come in, and when we diagnose someone with social anxiety disorder at the Renewed Freedom Center, the first response is, well, I'm not shy. I'm very outgoing. I'm popular in my school, or, you know, I'm very liked by a lot of my peers. I don't have social anxiety disorder.
And this is correct. So you have that. So there's, if you look at it as Venn diagrams, so there's certainly overlap. You will see a lot of shy people who also are socially anxious, and some who have a level that meets criteria for social anxiety disorder. But certainly you have people who are not shy and have social anxiety disorder, and who are also not shy. So it's there's overlap, but you can see differences in it. So it's hard to describe the typical person with social anxiety disorder, quite simply because there is such a heterogeneity.
Earlier, when you spoke of behavioral inhibition,
yes,
for a symptom of social anxiety disorder, what does that mean?
Behavioral inhibition is a temperament that basically describes shyness early on in life, which is a sort of expressed initially by being actually overly active, as an infant would have high reactivity to stimuli, such as, you know, loud tones or strange smells or tastes would make the infant very reactive and distressed almost. That then goes into, and it's a remarkable level of stability. Jerome Kagan has examined that quite closely, a professor at Harvard. And so at around 2 years of age, these people often then develop something that he called behavioral inhibition. They are then very timid and avoid interacting with strangers, would run to the mother or there's something new and would try to give, see comfort. And this then often, but not necessarily all the people, but this can then further lead to social anxiety later on during adolescence and then social anxiety disorder in adulthood. There is so behavioral inhibition is often a precursor for some people with social anxiety disorder. But again, as I said, there are plenty of people who have been very outgoing, who have never been shy and do not share the trait, but then also develop social anxiety disorder later on in life.
So if we're going to shift this a little bit towards treatment, what has sort of your research told you about what is the most effective treatment for social anxiety?
Yeah, I'd like to give you a little bit, maybe a background story that also illustrates sort of how the field has moved a little bit. So early on in the 70s, 80s, social skills trainings were very popular. For your listeners who don't know much about social anxiety disorder, they might jump to the conclusion, well, it probably has to do with social skills and they just don't have what it takes to interact normally with individuals and or effectively. And there was a boon of social skills trainings during this time. And so, you know, some people did improve because it included exposure interventions that is quite helpful. However, you sent the implicit message with these social skills trainings that you don't have what it takes, that there's something that you lack. And once you have the skill set, there's no reason to feel socially anxious and you just don't have what it takes. And therefore, I teach you now how to be a good speaker or how to introduce yourself in the best possible way or how to make friends. And it's still out there, by the way. It's still in the corporate world. These kind of skill sets are still strongly valued and highly valued. And people are still doing these kind of workshops everywhere.
Yeah, we have a lot of patients who come and said they've done all of these workshops.
Exactly.
And there's what's that? One where you speak and every time...
Toastmasters.
Yes, Toastmasters,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And then they're still anxious.
That's right.
There's still a problem.
Absolutely. And so it became pretty apparent that the social skills trainings are not really helping people quite as much as people were hoping. Also, during the same time was around propranolol, the beta blocker, as the main intervention for any kind of performance in social anxiety. And again, you know, it helped for some, but the majority really did not improve much. Then in sort of the 80s and 90s, people thought, well, maybe it has to do with the way they are thinking, or the way they are perceiving things. And so the treatments were focused on sort of thought patterns that they had and correcting thinking patterns. And people used exposures primarily as a way of activating these thought patterns. So basically, these are typically role play situations, and then people had to verbalize what they were thinking, and then correcting sort of any or replacing sort of maladaptive thoughts with more adaptive thoughts.
But so replacing thoughts that doesn't work with thoughts that are more realistic and healthy.
Yeah, and it was very simplistic and mechanistic, so people were really verbalizing, so I can do this despite my anxiety. So you would, the therapist would probe then, okay, now what is your thought? I can do it without, despite my anxiety. It's silly.
It sounds like you start creating a bunch of robots who yes. would be walking around reproducing the same line, the same yes. speech,
yeah.
yet there's still a problem.
Yes, and there's still a problem, exactly. And in a way, sort of the idea was almost like replacing a chip, you know, taking one chip out and putting another chip in. And again, it led to the improvement within, you know, a moderate range. Some people, there were people who clearly took to it, but the majority did not. That just didn't help. So then I thought, quite honestly, I thought the field needed something else. It was, certainly there was a lot of wisdom in CBT and traditional CBT. There was also some wisdom in social skills trainings. What struck me in these treatments was that people did like the exposures themselves. That they somehow thought that there was something in it, but it was not clear how to make the exposures most successful. What also struck me was that the social skills themselves didn't really matter that much. In fact, it was apparent that people in these groups that we've formed, their social skills was just really fine. They didn't really require a whole lot of improved skills. They thought that their skills were pretty poor. But in fact, you could tell them, look, your skills are just fine. But they would obviously say, you're just saying that because you're a therapist, you want to make me feel better. Also, there was one sort of critical incident that I had when I was doing a laboratory-based study where we compared people with social anxiety, with public speaking anxiety in particular, with controlled people who did, and we put an ad out in the newspaper saying, are you usually not afraid of public speaking? We are looking for an interesting study at Stanford University, please. And we had some very bizarre people calling us. In one case, there was a Chinese businessman came in and who just didn't speak the language well. He just was a obviously wealthy person, intelligent person, but he couldn't speak English. And he responded to the ad that he was not afraid of public speaking. So we asked him now to give a speech about some three topics. And in front of a video camera, he babbled something along for 10 minutes until we asked him to stop. And I had no idea, really no idea what he was saying because we couldn't understand him. I thought it was my English back then because, you know. So afterwards, I asked my research assistant, what was he talking about? She said, I have no idea. I didn't understand it either. So in this case, social skills, meaning being able to speak the English language in a way that you can communicate to other people, was completely unrelated to his social anxiety. In fact, he enjoyed himself quite a bit. And he did communicate. I did understand that if we need him again, we should call him up. Social skills are very poorly associated with social anxiety disorder. There are plenty of people who have very poor social skills who have no social anxiety whatsoever. We have leaders in some big countries with horrible social skills and they couldn't care less.
Right.
I'm not going to go any further with that.
So what did you replace social skills with in your treatment?
So the point is, it's not the social skills that is a problem. It is the perception. It is the perception. What it boiled down to when we kind of looked at that is it really had everything to do with how you perceive yourself. See, it's kind of an odd thing with social anxiety. You're afraid of other people, but it's not really the person that scares you, but it's what you think the other person thinks of you. So it really requires, you know, a leap. Some people call it theory of mind. You have to be able to put yourself in the other person's point of view. It requires, you know, sophisticated skills, cognitive skills to do that. The problem with social anxiety disorder is that they view themselves as negative. So the idea is if you're not afraid, if you don't care what other people think, there's no room for social anxiety disorder. And in a way, that's what we want to push them. In our treatments, we want them to care less, to actually make them a tiny little bit more of a psychopath, a little bit less of an empathic person. If the whole world consisted of people with social anxiety disorder, it would be a very, very nice world because people would care a great deal about what other people think. In fact, we actually...
So the opposite of narcissism.
Of psychopathy. I think narcissism to some extent, but it's primarily also not caring what other people think. You couldn't care less. Obviously, we just want to push them a little bit in this direction. They're still very kind and very, very nice people after our treatments, but they just care a little bit less what other people think. In a way, the treatment requires the person to change a perception of self. The self is driving the social anxiety. And in a way, the self is a complicated construct. One of the important part of the self is sort of what a social aspect of the self. One can see it as a, you know, the self at least of two components of the core self that is sort of very much continuously with you from your birth to later on. It changes slightly, but a much bigger part of you is what I would call the social self that incorporates experiences that you've had with other people in the past, what you have currently with other people, and also how you see yourself in the world and the hierarchy of the social structure. So this social self changes, is malleable, and is depends on the experience that you have.
So if that's the case, then can somebody not have social anxiety at all, not care about what the world thinks as a child and adolescent, and then somewhere in adulthood develop social anxiety?
Yes, if the person at some point then learns how to care what other people think, that certainly is possible, but there may be experiences that pushes the person into that. But typically, it is much harder from I care too much to I don't care at all. We are sort of trained as social animals. We want to be part of a group. We have a strong sense of wanting to belong to a social network. That's why Facebook is popular. That's why Twitter is popular. Because we form social networks. We're social animals. We want to be part of a social group. And for that reason, it hurts us greatly if we have a sense that the social group doesn't want us and wants to exclude us. And we punish people based on that. This is how our entire society is set up. We punish people by taking them away from others, by sending them to prison, within the prison system, by sending them to solitary confinement. So we cut off social contact. This is the biggest punisher at a human can inflict on other humans is isolating them.
Or I'm also thinking bullying, right?
Of course.
In schools.
Yes,
that's
sure.
That's
yes,
another form
absolutely.
Of excluding that's why people, someone socially.
Absolutely. That's why people kill themselves because they are, and suicidality is at a heightened rate in people with social anxiety or because they feel lonely. They feel excluded. Loneliness is a strong predictor for all sorts of problems in life and also including physical problems. And the opposite is true. Being connected, having social connections is a strong predictor for healthy and happiness.
So in getting a person to not care about other people's perception, how do we go about doing that?
You know, when I started, we thought these exposures, as I mentioned, seem to like them. But I wanted to move beyond sort of role plays and actually scripting it and saying what I thought, why aren't we just going outside and do stuff outside? Why do we have to stay in this room and do role plays? It makes no sense. The world is out there. It's not in here. So we started doing some odd things with them. Initially, I thought they would never do that, first of all. I thought this is asking people to actually interact with people outside of the group environment and doing even things that would put them in an awkward situation in order to test some of these beliefs that they have, how people would respond. I wouldn't think they would do that. And I was surprised that they basically said, Dr. Hoffman, that's exactly what I want. Let's do more of that. This is exactly what we need. And we continued that. And we basically also asked them to come up with their own exposures. What do you think would be the most awkward situation for you? And they would tell us some bizarre stuff. And we said, really, you want to do that? I mean, it's fine. So we kind of restricted. So if it doesn't get you into serious trouble or other people into serious trouble, why not? Why not trying it out? If you don't get divorced, unemployed, go and throw into prison or hurt other people, yeah, let's try it.
Can you give us some examples of some of your famous social mishap exposures and ones that you came up with?
Oh, sure. I mean, it starts out, as simple as going outside and singing some silly songs in the subway or announcing every single subway stop that comes up or asking people for $100 on the street because you want to get rejected. And by the way, some of these, this is not new by any chance, by any way, in any way. Alice was famously very socially anxious and in particular he was very timid and didn't want to start conversations with females. So he put himself in such a situation by placing himself in Central Park somewhere on a bench and asking every single woman passing by if she wants to go out with him for a whole day. I think about 100 people or so he asked, and one person gave him her number. So this is these are examples. Some more odd ones is for a person going, and these are things that patients came up with, going to a bookstore asking for a book on farting, and obviously then the bookstore clerk would say, "What are you looking for?" And then we had to actually ask not to say "I'm sorry" or not to walk away, but rather than saying "I'm looking for books on the gas we pass when you eat certain meals." Or going to a CVS and asking for the smallest condoms that they have available, stuff like that.
So when I first started working at Renewed Freedom Center, we had to do a lot of different exposures. And we did one where you were in the room with some of those OCD and they had knives around the room. That was not a problem. Had to put your hand in fake vomit. That wasn't a problem for me. Even touching a toilet seat wasn't hard. But when I had to go outside on Sawtelle Boulevard and go and ask people for $20, I was just terrified. It was so hard for me. And it took me about 6 months to be able to do them just well enough to be able to help someone else do them.
You are not alone. So the problem that I'm facing when I go and talk about these treatments is not so much that patients don't want to do it. They actually really, really know exactly that's where we're going with that. And they take it to another level. They know what they want. But the problem is getting therapists to do it. And I often have to first actually, you know, in a way, treat the therapists to a level that they're comfortable doing it themselves. So we in workshops, it's exactly what I do. I do exposures with my therapists to get comfortable with asking patients to do it. And if patients sense that this is awkward for the therapist, it's not going to work.
You know, when I first met you a number of years ago, we were at a party and you took your drink and just dropped it right in front of me and kind of threw it on the ground in an effort to demonstrate how they were done. So does anything embarrass you anymore?
Maybe your question right now.
We have to make fools of ourselves? Is that the general gist?
Yeah. And not only that, but also realize that it's okay to screw up. This is life. It's totally fine, you know, to experience mishaps. This is just a fact of life. And not to be so hard on you, just to be experiencing that. And then if you have a problem with social anxiety, reevaluate what actually the actual consequences are. So we are creating a dissonance between what the expected outcome is to what actually is happening. So it's these mishaps do not lead to long-lasting negative consequences. Those things happen all the time. And if anything, you should learn to actually laugh about yourself. And that's often what we also create in our group. Humor is extremely helpful, not to the extent that you ridicule the person, but rather you laugh about that yourself. And often we send them out doing these kind of mishap exposures, and we reconvene in groups, and they often bring sort of little trophies with them to show what they've accomplished. Maybe $20 that they got from somebody or a condom that I'm not sure if they're a different size, but you know, this sort of thing. So it create also a sort of a competitive environment where they try to outperform each other. And
who can do the worst? Who can make themselves look the worst?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I guess the whole idea is to accept that this happens to all of us.
Yeah.
That we all experience these social mishaps. However, those of us who don't have social anxiety aren't ruminating over the fear of what everybody else is thinking.
I also have to say, many of your listeners will be angry at me. They will say this is outrageous and this is not at all touching on their problem and how dare I. That's what I typically get, by the way, when you introduce that. So it's also true for the therapist. They say this is nonsense. And you get this resistance. You get this quite simply because it means if I'm right, you really need to test it out and you really don't want to do that. And you find reasons why this is a really dumb idea. So I'm quite used to that. The data speak for themselves. If you do that, we get response rates consistently. Your listeners can look it up. It's 70 to 80% of people will respond very well. They are responders. And often, I would say, if you do it right, there's no reason why people have social anxiety disorder. I would go that far. It is a disorder, is a problem that is extremely debilitating, but that can be treated. These exposures are not a random acts of ridicule. You have to actually tailor them quite carefully to the individual. You have to figure out what it is that drives the fear. As I said, it's a very heterogeneous group. Some people will respond more to where you also introduce sort of physiological symptoms for some people. For others, it has to do with also there are plenty of issues that need to be considered. So my point is you have to tailor it carefully. You can't just come up with a list of things to look stupid and do it. No, it's not the way it works. So anyway, I'm quite comfortable and prepared that people will not take to it and will not like that.
How do you work with someone that shows up at your clinic and they say they have social anxiety and you get out there and you're doing exposures, but then they just freeze or they just say they just can't do it. Or if they do it, they do the absolute like minimal amount or they're clenching the entire time. And it's just so hard for them. It's just so hard. And they look at you and you feel like you're torturing them. What do you do?
Yeah. And it's a very good point. So, you know, exposure is not torture. Exposure is a way to experiment, to modify, to see what happens if you do something. For that reason, we go through great length to identify behaviors that maintain anxiety, that are leading up to the identifying avoidance, subtle avoidance behaviors, safety strategies that people do. So these kind of mishap exposures happen very late in treatment. And early on, we spend a great deal of time figuring out what it is that you do that keeps you in a state that is not comfortable, but makes you less uncomfortable. And sort of people have developed such strategies to survive these daily threats. And if you think about it, social anxieties, social situations are always there every day. And you don't extinguish, even though you're confronted with that all the time. You know, if you were spider phobic and you woke up with a spider on your lying next to you and you looked in the mirror with spiders hanging over you and you went in a bus with spiders everywhere and you went to walk with spiders on your desk, eventually you lose your fear of spiders because people are afraid of spiders and exposing them to spiders eventually leads to a reduction of spiders. That's not the case for social anxiety. You see people around you all the time. It's not the social object itself that fears that makes you scared, but it's the perception of what that means, how it relates to yourself. So for that reason, you need to target it in a different way than other fear situations.
Just to go back, because earlier you were saying that we are social beings. We have a high need to be wanted, to belong. And that was the purpose why Facebook, initially Friendster, now Instagram, Twitter was all created. Is there any research that points out what are the effects of the social media for people?
Yes, there
who
is.
Might have?
Absolutely, there is. Yeah. There are different personas you have on Facebook and Twitter than you have in real life. And you have, in a way, Facebook offers you an opportunity to portray yourself the way you would like to be or would like to be seen, or sort of it has sort of an ideal self-presentation. In a way, it can also, especially if you're in strong in a social network integrated through Facebook, it can have an isolating effect. It increases loneliness. It doesn't help, actually, because you spend less time in the real social world. This is certainly part of it, quite simply the time issue. But also it's sort of a discrepancy that causes distress. You know, they want to be different, but they're not. And Facebook sort of highlights that. So you're not who you are, really. Facebook has both a lot of leads to advantages and disadvantages in a social network. So if you do it within a framework that you actually connect with people who you care for, that can be quite helpful, or to organize things and so forth. If you use it as a replacement of your real social life, it has disastrous consequences.
For our audience, if there's someone out there that has social anxiety or knows someone that has social anxiety, is there a message that you'd like to convey to them?
Yes, you do not have to suffer in silence. You do not have to endure that. Social anxiety disorder is not disappearing all by itself. There is help available, and these treatments that are out there are extremely effective. It's not to say that exposure therapy is the only thing. Some people will respond to pharmacotherapy as well. It's totally fine. And also within the exposure framework, there are again, we need to tailor that to the individual. My point is, there's definitely help available, and there's no reason to suffer.
And since we're at the ADAA conference, for people who are looking for experts and specialists in this, they can always go to the therapist directory at ADAA.org.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have today. You've been listening to the Stressless Life podcast. Send questions, comments, or episode ideas to thestresslesslife@dryip.com. Check out our website at www.dryip.com/podcast. If you like what you've been hearing, please write us a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. Until next time, stay stressless.